slippers on shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Coral, the string.
Can't you buy our little dress?
Coral, the string.
Great gowns.
Coral,
beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
Coral,
no, it hasn't.
Hi, my name is Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit Podcast, the first episode of 2026. Everything's going to be different this year, Chelsea.
It's going to be way worse this year. The podcast and everything else.
I mean, that is certainly the case here in America. We should say that this episode is coming a day later because you are not here in the United States. You are in Australia, and it is it's tomorrow there.
It is tomorrow here. But I've had a very chill holiday, lots of time with Tat's family. And yeah, but I haven't really been doing much. I've been like lying by the beach and just like eating. Like all I do is go to restaurants here, basically. Although I did see a fuckette on the plane yesterday. Shout out to Anne.
Oh, wow. A fuckette in the wild.
See, I've been traveling within Australia. I just got back from a little beach town called Noosa, which was kind of bogan, kind of fab. What have you been up to? We literally haven't talked in like 3 weeks.
I know. Well, you're not missing much in the hellscape that is America right now. I mean, more locally, I gotta say that the vibes in LA are pretty atrocious. I have been run off the road this week, or almost run off the road, not once, but twice.
By who?
I know you're probably going to be like, oh, it's Lauren's road rage, but I just want to note it has gotten significantly better since having a baby. No, I don't know, distracted people. I then passed each person to be like, what was that about? Were they on their phone? No, they weren't even on their phone, Chelsea. People are just like detached from their brains.
Honestly, it's probably a survival instinct.
To run me off the road or to have their brains disconnected?
To have their brains disconnected.
But I just got back to LA a few days ago. Paul and I went to visit his family in Albuquerque. So that's where I spent most of the holiday. We took off on a 2-day road trip because we decided at some point that driving made more sense than just taking a 3-hour plane ride to Albuquerque.
Okay, to be fair, when you told me about your plans, I was like, why are they doing this? But I didn't want to overstep.
Somehow we convinced ourselves, because you have to take so much crap when you have a baby. And we sent you a photo of what it looked like where Morty was sleeping. Like it's a whole contraption called a slumber pod.
For sure. But you did devote 2 full days to transportation on both sides of the trip when it could have been, what, like 5 hours door to door?
Yeah, I don't think we would be doing it again. I don't know what it was. It didn't connect that we would be on the road 6 hours and then 6 hours with an infant until literally the day before we left. And I, of course, immediately made things worse by going to Reddit and being like, well, what do other parents have to say? And people were like, oh, no, you can, like, travel with a baby. You know, we did a 4-hour road trip. It only took us 8 hours to get there. I was like, oh, my God, what have I done to us? But it was fine. It was lovely. I have to say, I think our East Coast tour prepared Paul and I for road tripping with an infant. So, like, if you want to know what it was like for us.
What, because you were in the car with Tat?
Is Tat the baby in this metaphor? No, just do you remember that day where it was like we woke up, we performed a show in Philly, we woke up bright and early, we packed up all our shit, drove 6 hours to Pittsburgh, then performed a show, then woke up and went to Chicago, like packing up all the merch and driving from place to place. Like that is what traveling with an infant was like. So honestly, you know, to future parents who listen to Every Outfit Podcast, just go on a regional podcast tour where you force your spouses to be your roadies. And that's what traveling with an infant is like.
Well, I'm glad that you made it home in one piece.
I will say to give myself a little bit of kudos. Yes, it did take us multiple days to get back to Los Angeles, but that is because we took a little mini vacation. We stopped in Sedona. That's where we spent New Year's. And then we ended the trip in La Quinta, home of the Kardashians' many vacation homes. Unlike them, I didn't take a private jet from La Quinta back to Los Angeles. Because if I had done that, Chelsea, I wouldn't have been able to stop by our beloved Cabazon.
Oh, yeah. What's up with Cabazon these days? I haven't been there in like a year.
You gotta go. So you haven't been since they opened the Margiela outlet store?
No, I've been since then.
Okay, so they've opened a Margiela outlet store, and then they just had opened an Acne Studios outlet store.
That's great, because I feel like with the discount, like that could actually be a semi-affordable shop, comparatively.
It very much was, although I was feeling it for the sales associates there. For those who have not been to the Cabazon Outlet Malls, we, of course, speak about it constantly. It is our favorite place to go, especially on the way to the desert. Especially around the holidays, they have like additional discounts. So like at Prada, it was an extra 20% off. But like that sales associate was so haggard. I was there like January 3rd. I said, how are you doing? And she was like, she goes, I'm going to Europe next month for a vacation. But she's like, this started like 2 weeks before Thanksgiving.
That makes sense, because that's when the discounts start. And that's when you should really go to Cabazon. Before Thanksgiving or after New Year's.
Yeah, I felt like it was an auspicious way to start the year.
So shall we get back into our pop culture bullshit?
Absolutely. I mean, this week's episode is basically going to be a bit of a catch up for us. I cannot believe it, but award season has already begun. I feel like every year it starts earlier and earlier. And frankly, I never thought I would say this. I feel bad for celebrities.
Well, the Critics' Choice Awards fell dangerously close to Christmas, or to New Year's, I guess.
It was January 4th. I seem to remember the Critics Awards used to be just a very nebulous award show that happened kind of between the SAG Awards and the Oscars. And now it's like the first award show up. I mean, first of all, Leonardo DiCaprio almost didn't make it because he was stuck in St. Bart's. He didn't make it for the Palm Springs Awards, which happened the night before. Like, honestly, I know it's most people's, especially if you're an actor, like the dream to win an Oscar, but like the road you now have to go on as a contemporary celebrity to do that seems exhausting and honestly not worth it. Like, you got to go to Palm Springs, then you got to like what? Get a helicopter to make it to the Critics' Choice Awards.
Well, it makes sense that the Critics' Choice Awards have moved up, because this is the same strategy employed by emerging brands at New York Fashion Week, right? Like, they just do the show like the day before New York Fashion Week officially starts, so they get more attention. You don't get attention if your show is in the thick of everything.
Like the newly created Golden Eve award show evening, which we will get into in a second. Chelsea Handler hosted the Critics Awards. I think that's her like go-to award show that she now hosts.
Wait, it's called the Critics Awards now? It's not the Critics' Choice Awards? Did I just make that up?
No, it's still the Critics' Choice Awards. We need to get, we will get into in a second. You know, it's no longer the SAG Awards. It's now the Actors Award.
Which I deeply resent.
It's a terrible rebranding. I mean, it sounds like an award show, a fake award show invented for a Ben Stiller film.
Yeah, it does. I don't like it. The name isn't the problem with the SAG Awards. It's the fact that the SAG Awards has been historically broadcast on cable channels for the last 10,000 years. It's not the name that's the problem.
And now Netflix. And I've been on record in saying, Netflix, if you need people to host the live stream red carpet and give fashion commentary, look, we don't even need to be on the red carpet. We'll be like the B-list correspondents that the, you know how like E has B-list correspondents that are like 30 miles away at some hotel? We'll be those people.
Oh, yeah. We'll be at the Line Hotel in Koreatown.
Anyway, before we get into the Actors Award nominations, I assume you did not watch the Critics' Choice Awards, so I'll just tell you the winners. Amy Madigan won Best Supporting Actress in Weapons. Best Supporting Actor went to Jacob Elordi in Frankenstein, which is like, to me, a real wild card choice, because in my mind, I just feel like Sean Penn was going to walk away with all the supporting actor awards. But, you know, this is the fun thing about award season, are these kind of wild card winners, and if that is going to mean anything as we head into the Oscars. Best Actress, Jessie Buckley for Hamnet. I've been on record. I won't see this film as it is a dead son film. That's not a spoiler alert. That is literally in the log line.
I'll watch it for the sake of the podcast and report back.
Thank you. And best actor, Timmy for Marty Supreme.
Great. He deserves it. Good for him. We'll talk about that next week, by the way. We had too many things in the outline today.
So heading into the Actors Awards, which announced their nominees earlier in this week, one battle after another led with a record-breaking 7 nominations, which is the most in the ceremony's history. Close behind that was Ryan Coogler's Sinners, which scored 5 nominations, which makes it the second most nominated film in SAG history. So it's still SAG history, but it's the Actor Awards. It's just such a downgrade. It doesn't sound good.
It's not memorable. We say the word actor too much anyway already.
There's also something chic about, you know, acknowledging the guild, the Screen Actors Guild, the Actor Award.
Yeah, you know what's chic? I mean, unions.
It is notable that all foreign films were shut out of the Actor Awards, which means Wagner Moura was not nominated for The Secret Agent. Neither was Renette Rensvi or Stellan Skarsgård for Sentimental Value. So, you know, America first, I guess, with these new Actors Awards.
Don't love that.
Once again, I am absolutely thrilled to share that this episode is sponsored by The RealReal. The RealReal is the best place to shop for authenticated luxury handbags, clothing, watches, and so much more. I think we can all agree that the prices of luxury goods have gotten completely out of hand in recent years. Like, I'm not paying $500 for a pair of sunglasses on principle. Especially now that I've seen how far $500 can go on The RealReal. If I'm paying that kind of money, I'm getting a Pucci gown, or I'm getting like 3 pairs of Manolo Blahnik shoes. And you know how I've made my money go even further on The RealReal? Selling with them. I sold a host of pieces on The RealReal and chose store credit with my sales profits. So I sold my old Doen I don't wear anymore, and I plan to buy an exquisite vintage Mugler skirt suit with the proceeds. See, with The RealReal, the pieces that you would be normally priced out of become more attainable. I know if Chelsea was here, she'd be discussing what she recently purchased on The RealReal. And I know she's been buying things because they've all been sent to my house while she's in Australia. We'll do an unboxing during the next ad. Which brings me to a very important point. You guys better be shopping on The RealReal, because if they stop booking ads with us, Chelsea may fall into a deep depression. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. With thousands of new arrivals daily, no one does resale like The RealReal. And now get $25 off your first purchase when you go to therealreal.com/outfit. That's therealreal.com/outfit to get your $25 off. Start shopping now at therealreal.com/outfit. So we have male actor in a leading role, Timothée Chalamet, Marty Supreme, Leonardo DiCaprio, One Battle After Another, Ethan Hawke, Blue Moon, Michael B. Jordan for Sinners, Jesse Plemons for Begonia. Interesting thought as a lead actor. I would have put him in the supporting actor category. I think a rare case, you know, usually actors will go into the supporting category to kind of help their chances to win. I think this is the rare case where someone that I would categorize as a supporting actor went into the lead actor role.
He was definitely the lead. He had the most screen time, and he had the most iconic supporting actor of his own, which is what made his performance so major, whoever that guy was that played his cousin.
See, that's the award we need to add to the Actors Awards, which is like supporting actor that helped the lead actor the most. I guess that is best supporting actor, but like a duo.
He should have been nominated for best supporting actor. He was major.
Yes, he was sadly shut out, going to male actor in a supporting role, Miles Canton for Sinners, Benicio del Toro for One Battle After Another, Jacob Elordi again in Frankenstein. Like, there's something about his nomination for Frankenstein, a movie that Paul and I started, got about 5 minutes into it, we're like, we can't do this, and noped out of it.
Okay, once again, I will watch that for the sake of the show.
Paul Mescal, nominated for a supporting role for Hamnet, and Sean Penn in One Battle After Another.
I'm rooting for Sean Penn.
I'm on record. I don't think he needs another major award, but like he was incredible in that film. So female actor in a leading role, we have Jessie Buckley in Hamnet. She is the favorite to win. Rose Byrne in If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, which you and I both agree we need to watch. Emma Stone in Begonia. Chase Infinity, one bell after another. And then Kate Hudson in Song Sung Blue. Do you know about this film?
Yes, because I'm in Australia and Hugh Jackman is in it.
Oh, I forgot about that.
It's a big hit. Or at least I hear people talking about it.
But it is a fictional film about a real life couple and their inspiring story about being a Neil Diamond tribute band.
I know. I've heard about this. Actually, when we were in New York, our friend was like, do you want to come to this thing at this bar? Hugh Jackman and Kate Hudson are performing. And I was like, honestly, I'd rather die. I'm good. Tat went, though.
What'd she say?
I don't think it spoke to her from a musical standpoint, but she had a fun night. Well, can we get into the ensemble category? Because this is where the SAG Awards really shines. It has an award for an entire cast, which I wish the Oscars had as well. And do you have the nominations in front of you? I don't.
You're referring to ensemble and not just stunt ensemble in a motion picture, because they also have that. Okay, you have Frankenstein, Hamnet, Marty Supreme, One Battle After Another, Sinners.
I hope Marty Supreme wins just because the most random people would all get SAG awards, which is not to say that they're not deserving. Like, Fran Drescher deserves a SAG award.
The former president of the Screen Actors Guild.
Like, Sandra Bernhard, like, should have gotten a SAG award for The King of Comedy, but she could win one as part of the ensemble in Marty Supreme. Also, Abel Ferrara randomly getting a SAG award would be cool.
I have not seen Marty Supreme yet, but I have heard that Abel Ferrara, one of my favorite directors, and more importantly, one of my favorite fashion models and guest of a late night show. If you've never seen him on Conan O'Brien, go look it up on YouTube.
He's acted in a lot of movies, mostly independent films, but it just would be funny if he got an award for acting. And not directing.
Yes. Well, again, this is a very interesting award season. It's kind of random. It seems like the best supporting actress, Amy Madigan, is just going to sweep with Weapons. Although, it could change. But like the idea of someone winning for a horror film doesn't typically happen. It's usually shut out.
I'm obsessed with that. She killed it. Everyone was obsessed with her. She deserves the awards.
But it does seem like they're kind of early front runners: Jessie Buckley, Amy Madigan, Paul Thomas Anderson. I think Ryan Coogler for Sinners will probably take Best Original Screenplay if anyone's asking. Oh, should I start betting on this?
We could.
But it does seem like there's going to be a lot of career awards. And that's what I feel like with Amy Madigan, who's been in the business for 40 years. Certainly Paul Thomas Anderson. I think the industry just feels like it's time to finally give him the Best Director Oscar for whenever he is nominated. But I don't know about Best Picture. It's anyone's game.
Okay, what else do we need to talk about?
Well, I was trying to bring up Paul Thomas Anderson, One Battle After Another, so that we could transition into talking about Esty Heim's wedding on New Year's Eve. A bold date to pick on the social calendar as your wedding. That really shows you how important you are to your famous friends like Taylor Swift.
I love the idea of a New Year's Eve wedding because I hate going out on New Year's Eve. I very rarely have fun at New Year's Eve parties. So I would love to be invited to an event that I actually cared to go to with something on the agenda beyond just like wearing stupid novelty glasses and getting wasted.
Well, it was important enough for Taylor Swift, Paul Thomas Anderson, and I gasped when I saw the very grainy paparazzi photos of Taylor Swift walking in the rain with Stevie Nicks. And I, of course, immediately texted you. And with the time difference, I was like, you need to understand that this is happening right now in California.
Seeing Taylor and Stevie together made me emotional. These are my girls. It did remind me, though, of the Grammy performance that they did together in 2010. I don't know if you remember this, Lauren. It was when Taylor Swift was nominated for the Fearless album. So they performed Rhiannon together, and then it like moved into love story. And it was honestly like the worst performance that Taylor has ever given in her life, if I'm being brutally honest. And it was critically panned at the time, so much so that it inspired Taylor to write the song Mean. So she ended up on top in the end, really.
Would you be shocked to know that I don't remember that performance, Chelsea? But thank you for your very evocative retelling of this performance.
Well, I wasn't a fan at the time and was obviously a huge Stevie Nicks fan. So I was like, what the fuck is this? But she also rides really hard for the Haim sisters. If you'll remember, when Christine McVie passed away, she like posted Haim lyrics on her Instagram and was like, I wish I could have been there to sing this Haim song to Christine in her final moments.
This was Stevie Nicks?
Yeah. So I think it's cool. I mean, she's mentored both of them in a really major way. And with Taylor, I mean, you could really see her influence, at least visually, in the what was it? The Evermore section of the Eras tour, which was a lot of like hooded cloaks and shit like that.
Okay, it feels like you could go on for 45 more minutes about...
No, I'll stop. What do you
Taylor
have to say?
We should say that Esty Haim, the eldest Haim sister, married tech entrepreneur Jonathan Levin on New Year's Eve. I want your opinion on her wedding dress. When I first saw that bulbous coat, I was like, oh, Batsheva designed this. I did not realize it was Vuitton until I saw the Vogue video.
Honestly, I kind of can't figure out how I feel about it, which means I think I think it's kind of major. Like when I first saw it, I was like, no. But I love an 80s bridal look. And this does look like something that Shelley Long might wear in Troop Beverly Hills. A wedding dress like this, like, should be worn by someone who proudly voted for Ronald Reagan. It gives that.
I've been on record. We've discussed this before, I think, in a hotline call about my least favorite wedding dresses, where I don't like when brides go overly conservative, especially if that's not their aesthetic. But like that, this look works for Esty Haim, like, very well. Like, it's kind of off-putting, but then I'm also like attracted to it.
That's exactly what it is. It's off-putting, but I'm into it. It's definitely wearing her. Like, there's no question about that. And I think the thing about the Haim sisters is that they inherently have this very laid-back 1970s type glamour that I would think they would all be in Rodarte or something like that. I get why they're in Louis Vuitton, because obviously they have this very fruitful and productive relationship with that brand. So the choice of designer does not surprise me at all. But yeah, I was just surprised that she went so Republican with it.
I do think, I mean, I got married in the summertime, but I do love winter weddings because I think it adds a level of drama of wearing long coats or long sleeves that I really appreciate. And frankly, I'm jealous of. I think also part of your confusion about the dress, and maybe I'm projecting my own confusion, is like once that jacket comes off, it's a very basic, anyone could have designed it, a thin spaghetti strapped wedding dress underneath it.
I hear what you're saying. It is still avant-garde to me because it's so bulbous. Like in the front, it's like a very extreme shape. But yes, it certainly looks way more normal than when we get the full ensemble with the jacket and the veil and stuff. I don't know. After having this conversation with you, I'm like, actually, I really fuck with this. It's insane. It's cool. And no one else is wearing stuff like this when they get married. So good for her.
No, we're all wearing the same Vivian Westwood short dress.
You and Charlie.
Well, I mean, she's just a very cool person. And it was a cool wedding and a cool wedding dress and a cool day after the wedding, because we learned that Paul Thomas Anderson programmed a 24-hour wedding film festival. Someone snuck a photo and posted it online.
Was it really 24 hours? Because wasn't it just like five movies? It wasn't 24 hours. That would have been crazy. It was like a sunrise to late night kind of situation, I believe.
9 a.m. to 1 a.m. So whatever that is, 18 hours?
I actually know someone that went to this wedding, and I have to ask her how many of these films she actually committed to.
Well, I want to know where this film screening is happening.
Surely there's a movie theater in Ojai.
But imagine being hungover after the eldest Heim sister's wedding and you're like, oh, we gotta go. So we should just say, here are the movies. 9 a.m., it begins with Repo Man. 11 a.m., Casablanca. 1:30 to 4:30. See, that's the time period I'm going to this film festival. A little tea time, Barry Lyndon screening, I'm in.
Wait, when does Barry Lyndon start? I think I may be too hungover for that even.
1:30 p.m.?
I would have made Barry Lyndon a little bit later. Personally.
Well, this is where, to me, like, the film festival really takes off. And PTA is cooking with gas, as they say, because you got Barry Lyndon. Then from 5 to 8, you have Casino. Then 8:30 to 10:30, Birdcage. And then the last film up from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m., Father of the Bride. No word on if it's the original Elizabeth Taylor version or the Steve Martin, Diane Keaton version. Because I feel like PTA would program the original Elizabeth Taylor film, but Esty Heim would probably be like, I need the remake from 1991.
It's definitely the Steve Martin one, I would assume. And yeah, I think realistically for me, I would be coming in at Casino or possibly even the Birdcage, depending on my level of illness. But I think it's such a cute idea.
Frankly, I'm jealous that I didn't think of this. This episode is brought to you by IQBar, our exclusive snack, hydration, and coffee sponsor. IQBar protein bars, IQ Mix hydration mixes, and IQ Joe mushroom coffees are the delicious, low-sugar, brain and body fuel you need to win your day. The new year means a clean slate, time to transform frustration into fuel and power your day with IQBar. I don't know about all that, but I do know that I love IQBar. I always have their protein bars stashed in my purse so I never get hangry, and their hydration mixes are my go-to after a workout. Look, I have tried a lot of protein bars and hydration mixes in my life, and I truly love the flavors IQBar offers. Where else can you get a yuzu mango hydration mix co-developed with the man who created the French Laundry? Thomas Keller also developed a salted caramel chip with toasted macadamia nut bar that I am dying to try. Curious about IQBar but don't know where to start? The Ultimate Sampler Pack is a great way to try all IQ products and flavors. You get 9 IQ bars, 8 IQ mix sticks, and 4 IQ Joe sticks. And right now, IQBar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% off all IQBar products, including the Ultimate Sampler Pack, plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text OUTFIT to 64,000. Text OUTFIT to 64,000. That's OUTFIT to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details.
So shall we get into the Golden Eve?
It finally happened, the most confounding addition to award season. It happened Tuesday night, but it aired in a broadcast on CBS Thursday night. I watched it, Chelsea.
I consumed it in clips on YouTube.
Well, you didn't miss much because I went to the YouTube channel for the Golden Globes this morning only to realize that literally every segment of the broadcast show was clipified and put up on YouTube.
So Sarah Jessica Parker received the Carol Burnett Lifetime Achievement Award. Is that what it's called?
Excellence in Comedy. I don't know. It's all made up. This award started in 2018. It is the kind of the comedy arm to the Cecil B. DeMille Award that, by the way, used to be in the main broadcast. They pulled that out of the main broadcast and now have created its own evening and mini award show dedicated to two people.
Which I think kind of sucks. Like, I would rather have SJP have her moment in front of everyone at the Golden Globes, as she so richly deserves.
Well, this is what I'm curious about, is this seems to be, we talked about it at the time when it was announced, that this is kind of the Hollywood Foreign Press's version of the Governor Awards, which the Academy Awards do. And during the main Oscars broadcast, they're like, we did this thing a few months ago and here are the highlights. And oh, and like they'll point to them in a box and be like, these are the winners. Like, I do wonder if Sarah Jessica Parker is still here in Los Angeles because she will be in the room Sunday night.
Yeah, she probably will. So Kristen Davis and Matthew Broderick introduced her.
Matthew Broderick had two separate segments where he talked about his wife. He started by speaking about meeting with her. Then there were several clip packages, one dedicated to her film and television and producing and theater career. Most notably in this clip package, Carrie Bradshaw, not in there. I was like, what's that about? And then I was like, I'm an idiot. Of course, Carrie Bradshaw's getting her own clip montage.
Yeah, I wondered about that also.
And then, yeah, he came back out to give her the award. And also, for those who didn't watch, told us an anecdote where he said that he was glad that he didn't say his first opinion when he read the Sex and the City pilot, which is, you really want to do TV?
I thought Kristen was quite cute. She like cried during her little intro.
I got emotional. I started to think about you and I and the message of Sex and the City. And as Kristen said, you know, your chosen people as family. And I was like, Chelsea's my chosen people. I met her in New York.
It was all very touching. Although, did you notice that Sarah Jessica didn't thank the actresses by name? She just mentioned the characters.
I did indeed.
Which I fully get. She also gave Darren Star a shout out, gave Michael Patrick King a shout out. Her lawyer, her agent, who famously told her to keep her wardrobe from Sex and the City and from all of her films.
I thought it was interesting. I mean, this is very, from what we know about Sarah Jessica Parker, very her to shout out how long even these industry relationships have gone. You know, her husband of almost 30 years, her agent of nearly 40 years. Yes, her lawyer of 35 years. So she is a loyal person.
One of them was like 45 years. I was like, damn, this is longer than I've been alive. That Sarah Jessica Parker has had this lawyer or whoever it was.
Can we just go back to Kristen for a second? Because I thought she looked incredibly chic with those aviators that were sort of, I assume they were her reading glasses, but aviators. I always liked that as a look.
Yeah, me too.
We should say Evan Handler was also there. David Eigenberg. Chris Noth, not surprising that he wasn't there. John Corbett, I was a little surprised not to see him at the Golden Eve.
Cynthia Nixon, not there because she's in that Broadway show, so she couldn't go. Kim Cattrall, not there for obvious reasons.
Did she thank Pat?
No.
That's interesting.
I wouldn't read into that. I'm sure there's a million people on Sex and the City that contributed to the show being fucking major. You know, she didn't thank the writers either.
Fair enough. You're right. Jenny Bix didn't get a shout out, but she did thank her lawyer for putting in a clause that she could keep all of the costumes.
But my main takeaway is that Sarah Jessica Parker seemed genuinely quite moved to be receiving this award. She is, I don't want to say a humble person, but it seems like she feels things more deeply.
I mean, it's richly deserved. If you think about the landscape of television and what this Carol Burnett Award means, there's no other comedic actress on television. Like, Carrie Bradshaw is one of the great comedic characters of the last 30 years.
Yes, and Carol Burnett is mother to her.
It does feel like the Carol Burnett Award was invented so that people can eulogize Carol Burnett while she's still alive. Because she was there.
And she, too, is a fashionable comedian. She is the blueprint for Carrie.
I have to say, I did feel bad for Sarah Jessica Parker. Have you seen some of the clips of her getting interviewed on the red carpet? Like, she's getting this historic award. Only a handful of people have received it. And to be fair, I mean, I guess if we were on the red carpet, we would ask the same thing. But like, all she's getting asked is like, so would you ever reprise your role as Carrie Bradshaw? It's like, let her have this evening.
I know. That must be so fucking annoying. Like, can you imagine? Like, it's all anyone asked you about. Then she finally did, and just like that, and did that for years. And the second that it's over, it's again, when are we getting another thing?
I mean, I suppose we're curious as well, but her answer was this: I hear lots of very original ideas, all lovely and well-intentioned and often very clever, but the only thing that really matters is what excites Michael Patrick King, and right now he's just not thinking about that.
Yeah, he's thinking about the comeback, as he should be. He should stop thinking about Carrie Bradshaw for a while, actually. It's probably good for his mental health.
Well, to me, I just felt like that seemed like an answer to Princess Nokia. It's like, sorry, Chelsea and I are never going to write for any future version of Sex and the City.
Honestly, the more that I think about it, I could see a Samantha spinoff happening before I can see all the girls getting together again and doing some other movie or some other thing like that. Because with a Samantha spinoff, people would be excited because they would not know what to expect from it at all. We miss seeing Kim Cattrall. You know, not everyone caught Glamorous and the Queer as Folk reboot. We did, but a lot of people missed that. And I think we all do want to celebrate that character.
Absolutely. I mean, what could go wrong? Resolutions come and go, but real, lasting growth takes time. That's why I love that Nutrafol isn't promising a miracle in 30 days. They're here to help you grow your hair and confidence from within, one day at a time. Honestly, I think the only resolution I haven't broken year over year is my commitment to Nutrafol in my daily routine. That's probably why Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement brand, trusted by over 1.5 million people. I am still on my postpartum journey and use Nutrafol because it targets the key root causes of postpartum thinning. Physical and emotional stress, under that daily, hormonal changes, yep, and nutrient depletion. So that with consistent daily use, you'll start to see thicker, fuller hair, and less overall shedding. Nutrafol hair growth supplements are peer-reviewed, NSF certified for sport, and clinically tested to measure improvements in growth, quality, and strength. See thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair with less shedding in just 3 to 6 months with Nutrafol. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter promo code OUTFIT. Find out why Nutrafol is the best-selling hair growth supplement brand at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code OUTFIT. That's Nutrafol.com, promo code OUTFIT. Okay, do we want to discuss, just to wrap things up, the last two episodes of Heated Rivalry? We're probably like the last podcasters to talk about the end of the first season of Heated Rivalry, but...
Yeah, I don't think we need to go in deep, but episode 5 is one of the most incredible episodes of television that I've ever seen. Truly. Like, episode 5 was shockingly good and kind of came out of nowhere, I thought. Which is not to say that the first 4 episodes weren't good. I just feel like episode 5 took it to a different level.
Well, also, Ilya's Russian monologue to Shane, when you learn that that actor basically had a week's notice before he went to Canada to start shooting the show, and he just has an ear for languages but didn't speak Russian, learned it in basically a month, and was able to do this amazing monologue. Shame on you, award shows. Let the Canadian produced shows be nominated.
I think he's going to be huge. I think we're days away also from him getting a major contract with a luxury brand.
I was trying to think of the last time we've had this kind of a star is born moment for these two actors, because we live in a time where there just aren't movie stars anymore. Like, the concept is the role, or like the closest thing you have is maybe,
Timmy.
You know, Michael B. Jordan. Timmy, Michael B. Jordan, like someone that if you see them, you are going to go to the theater for them. But I mean, this show came out of nowhere. I mean, they literally, no one knew their names 6 weeks ago. And now, like, they have to have security when they go out in public. Like, I can't think of the last time something like that has happened pop culturally, certainly for an actor.
Totally. Also, just like, from my perspective, I've seen a million films that tell the story of two closeted gay guys whose love can only flourish in the shadows. Like, that is a predictable narrative at this point. However, Heated Rivalry, in telling a story that is very familiar, avoided a lot of tropes that we are used to seeing. Like, normally in these sorts of things, the two guys have a brief moment of passion before being outed, being publicly shamed, you know, being murdered, dying of AIDS, committing suicide, what have you. In Heated Rivalry, neither of the characters hate themselves, which we never really see. Their girlfriends don't hate them. At least one of their families doesn't hate them. And there are other gay people in the world of the show. And as the show goes on, they gradually get on the same page and work towards having a stable relationship, which I feel like we never really see.
Well, that's the joy of it being a television series versus a movie.
Yeah.
I feel like we don't need to say what happens in episode 5, right? I mean, who isn't watching the show? I think to your point about it doesn't fall into the tropes that a lot of gay stories fall into, like, it has this crossover appeal because there is this yearning between these two characters. The chemistry between them, we've already talked about this, is so incredible that you have gay audiences watching it, lesbian audiences watching it, straight women watching it. Paul watched the last two episodes with me. Like, he's straight men are into this show. Did you see the hockey players, the straight hockey players talking about this show?
No, they're into it.
Yeah. I forget what the podcast name is, but they're these straight hockey players that already have a podcast. I think they're brothers too. And they're just talking about how great the love story is. So this has had such incredible crossover appeal that, you know, we all collectively were screaming, let's go to the cottage.
Totally. Well, it's also nice that Heated Rivalry also manages to avoid another trope, which is presenting this very sort of desexualized version of a gay relationship so that it is palatable to straight people and so that it serves like a love is love is love kind of political agenda.
Right.
Usually things fall in one camp or the other. This is somehow outside of both of these things that we're very used to seeing.
Shall we get into the cottage episode? Do you know that they built that cottage from scratch?
No, that's crazy.
I find it crazy as well, mostly because one of the stories that has come out of the success of this show is how bare bones the budget was. I mean, for those who've seen the show, they know it, like, the production value is incredible, but they must have stored away a ton of money to build the cottage, which only appears in an episode.
It could come back in season two.
Season two, which we're not getting until 2027, which there's been a lot of discord online about that. Of like, you know, Jacob Tierney only took 37 days to shoot the first season. Why do we have to wait a year and a half? It's like, because that's just shooting the show. You also don't know how long ago they shot the show, but like, he has to take the books, break it down, write 6 new episodes, pre-production, shoot the show, post-production. These actors are about to be booked and busy, so they're going to have to work around their schedules.
I don't know. I think they need to fast track that shit. Surely they can. The book already exists. I'm not saying that we should expect a 3-month turnaround for the next season of Heated Rivalry, but it's just so hugely successful, and they fumbled the bag by only having 6 episodes. That's crazy. They didn't fully believe in it, which I understand.
No.
They thought they were going to lose money. I mean, 6 episodes is crazy. I'm wondering at what point we're going to have like 4 episode seasons of television shows. It seems like that's where things are heading.
Oh, we're going to go full BBC model?
Well, even with All's Fair, weren't there only like 8 episodes of that? Like, that's
crazy.
Yeah,
I think 9.
Less than 10 is not acceptable. We need to go back to making television shows that have like 20-something episodes a season.
I mean, I'm here for that. As someone that grew up watching WB shows, the more the better. Remember with like Beverly Hills 90210 or like Saved by the Bell, those shows were so popular that they would do like summer seasons? That's what I need with yes. Heated Rivalry. It's like, just give me like what Ilya and Shane are doing in the summertime.
That would be perfect.
Something I knew about the author, Rachel Reed, that wrote the Game Changers series that I did want to bring up when we were first talking about this, but she was diagnosed with Parkinson's, which has made it very difficult for her to write future books. But in the popularity of the show and the creator talking about and the actors talking about her diagnosis, a top neurologist reached out to her to like get her an appointment. So like, that tells you how bad healthcare is in North America, that like, you need to have a worldwide phenomenon to get adequate healthcare.
Oh God, that's so depressing.
This episode is brought to you by MUBI, the global company that champions great cinema. From iconic directors to emerging auteurs, there's always something new to discover. With MUBI, each and every film is hand-selected so you can explore the best of cinema. Again, I am here to ask you, have you seen Die, My Love? If not, why not? We've been telling you to watch it for months. But it doesn't matter because you're in luck. Die, My Love is now streaming on MUBI in the US. Die, My Love is Lynn Ramsey's shocking new film about the trappings of marriage and motherhood, featuring a career-defining performance by Jennifer Lawrence, and Robert Pattinson is also there.
Kidding. He is also incredible in the film. This film also features the most disturbing use of Tony Basil's Mickey imaginable. Come for the psychosexual drama, stay for Sissy Spacek as Jennifer Lawrence's rifle-toting mother-in-law. To stream the best of cinema, you can try Mubi free for 30 days at Mubi.com/everyoutfit. That's Mubi.com/everyoutfit for a whole month of great cinema for free. Well, speaking of depressing, we have basically the rest of the episode is going to be bad news that we need to get into. So let's play the theme.
Bad news!
Only on Every Outfit.
Chelsea, I've been meaning to ask you, and we're a little bit past the season, but there was no place in December to ask you about your favorite special interest, JonBenet Ramsey, because as we know, or I've been made aware, December is JonBenet season.
Okay. I never said that December was JonBenet season, by the way. But yes, obviously, since it's the holidays, I've been thinking about JonBenet a lot. She died on Boxing Day. This is the 29th consecutive year that she has not received justice. And last year, around the holidays, I got really obsessed with the case and I spent like a truly unhealthy amount of time in the subreddit. I managed to reel that in for most of the year.
Well,
I managed to stay out of it. But then obviously when the holidays came along, I got back into it again. I went down the rabbit hole.
I mean, not to blow up your spot, but your wife has been sending us in our group chat recordings of you talking about JonBenet as she's like, we have to go to dinner. And then she also sent us a photo of you guys at a cafe, and you clearly were on the subreddit.
I wasn't on the subreddit. I was reading the new Daily Mail article with John Ramsey that just came out last week. So sue me. And actually, this year, I do have an update. There is new news about JonBenet. Her case is no closer to being solved, so don't expect that. But I have an update about this JonBenet Ramsey limited series, which we talked about last year. It is called Unspeakable, The Murder of JonBenet Ramsey. It stars Melissa McCarthy as Patsy Ramsey, potentially the best casting we've seen in our lifetime. Clive Owen is playing John Ramsey.
I can't see, by the way. Clive Owen's limited series roles. I mean, I believe his last role was in American Crime Story as Bill Clinton. So it's like he's been Bill Clinton and now John Ramsey.
Okay, this is a bizarre casting detail, but Margot Martindale is playing JonBenet's grandmother. And this is noteworthy because Margot Martindale also played JonBenet's housekeeper in the 2000 television movie Perfect Murder, Perfect Town, which is based on the book of the same name.
Oh my God. Is that the clip that you sent me of a scene from this TV movie where it's very clear that the actor playing John Ramsey when he discovers JonBenet is holding a mannequin or like a large doll?
Yeah, since we just rewatched Mannequin, the incredible Kim Cattrall film that we did a VIP episode about this month. Yes, I've been thinking about mannequins, and there was a prominently featured mannequin in this television movie, which is not that good. No one needs to watch it. I just, being a JonBenet completist, felt that I had to. It is on YouTube in its entirety, if anyone gives a fuck.
So when is this Murder of JonBenet limited series coming out, Chell?
We don't know. And it's concerning because it is now rumored that this series may never see the light of day because in October, Matthew Bellany, who is an entertainment reporter for Puck, wrote in his newsletter that Paramount Plus is nervous about releasing the series because they fear legal retribution from John Ramsey and Burke Ramsey, who are the surviving family members and who historically have been very, very litigious. Specifically, in 2016, Burke sued CBS for defamation because they aired a true crime miniseries called The Case of JonBenet Ramsey, which we watched together when I was living with you. back in the day.
Yes, we did. There were signs of your hyperfixation.
That series suggested that Burke, who is JonBenet's brother, killed her, and that his parents then helped cover up that crime. They sued CBS for $750 million, or Burke sued CBS, and they did end up having to pay a settlement, but we have no idea what the amount of that settlement was. No clue.
And we should say that CBS is the sister company of Paramount, and that this Unspeakable, The Murder of JonBenet Ramsey, is currently a Paramount Plus limited series because it comes out of Taylor Sheridan's production company. And so, yes, the rumor from Puck News is that they are going to dump the series. And yeah, it may never see the light of day. But Chelsea, I have some intel because I just happen to know someone who knows someone that knows a little something about this. And don't worry your pretty little head, the show will see the light of day.
On Paramount, or are they trying to sell it? Because I heard they may try and sell it to another streaming service.
Yes. That's the tea. I just want to show you, I got you a little present for your collection, which is the latest National Enquirer, which has JonBenet on the cover. And it says, after 29 years, Trump will solve JonBenet's murder. So I was like, well, I got to get this for Chell.
That's perfect. I do need that. Honestly, I wish Trump would try and solve JonBenet's murder. I mean, I think her murderer is no longer with us, so I don't know what good it would do, but...
Do you want to reveal who you think did the crime now? Because you've changed. You were... There's a lot of... I mean, we went over this last year, but there are acronyms.
Last year, I was noncommittal to a theory.
But there are acronyms in the subreddit. Can you take us through the different ones? There's BDI. Burke did it.
There's BDI, Burke did it. There's BDIA, Burke did it all, which means the blunt force trauma and the strangulation. There's PDI, Patsy did it. JDI, John did it. RDI, the Ramseys did it, but we don't really know who. And then the most baffling of all, IDI, which is that an outside intruder did it, which is a theory that has picked up steam recently because of the Netflix series that came out last year, which was called Cold Case, Who Killed JonBenet Ramsey, which really pushed the intruder theory. The intruder theory is what John Ramsey has been talking to the media about for ages. They believe that it was an outside intruder, but given the evidence, to me, the intruder theory really defies all logic.
This is connected. Do you want to know what this National Enquirer story is? Because it quite... I have to show you how large the typeface is. They're truly making a mountain out of a molehill. It literally is just John Ramsey is exclusively revealing to the National Enquirer that he thinks that Trump could solve the case. That's it.
It's not surprising. John Ramsey is a Republican. He's probably obsessed with Trump. And the longer they keep this sort of, we need to retest the DNA narrative in the headlines, it diverts suspicion away from the family.
You were formerly RDI.
I think it was Patsy, but with some involvement of John covering up the crime. I don't know at what point he was looped in. I do not think it was Burke.
Okay, there we go. Because, yeah, I mean, we did receive in the group chat, you were like, guys, I figured it out. Because your Patsy did it all.
Well, I think that John could have potentially been involved in some of the staging. Maybe. Patsy definitely wrote the note. I will die on that hill.
There's other depressing shit we need to get into, but this is definitely worthy of a VIP episode. This might be the most conspiracy theory that we get.
It's not a conspiracy theory. The evidence is out there. The grand jury back in the day did want this to move to trial, did believe that the Ramseys were guilty. So they just couldn't determine which one actually killed her.
We should note the thing about the limited series is that the creators of the show have been like, we know who murdered JonBenet and that will be revealed in the series.
Has anyone said anything like that? Because that's news to me.
Oh, that might be my special intel as well.
That's fascinating because last year at the Golden Globes, a journalist from Entertainment Tonight asked Melissa McCarthy about the JonBenet Ramsey miniseries because I think it had been recently announced. And this is what she said.
It's been quite a challenge. Yeah. It's living with that, you know, poor family that I, my heart goes out to them. And
that we
still it's still a blood sport. Yeah. I love Patsy. I love the family. I think we're putting a really great version of it out. I think I'm hoping we're giving them their humanity as well as telling the story.
This shocked me because I was like, oh my God, you're playing Patsy Ramsey and you think she wasn't involved? Like, that's to me, I'm like, what? This makes me think that this series is pushing the intruder theory, which is like completely baffling to me, like insane.
Well, Chelsea, all I have to say is when you get back to Los Angeles, if you would like to know who murdered JonBenet Ramsey, I have the connect.
Well, guys, this year, I think we're going to get a lot of JonBenet stuff as it is the 30th anniversary. We will hopefully get this miniseries that hopefully does not push the intruder theory. I also expect that we will get a major interview from John Ramsey and possibly Burke. I mean, Burke has been much more camera shy than his father, but he did give that completely unhinged interview to Dr. Phil a while back, which contradicted statements made by his parents about that evening. But
anyway, that was the 1-2 punch of that CBS lawsuit, right? Where they did that docuseries. And then Burke, I think to try to mitigate the damage done, went on Dr. Phil and was like a complete weird shit.
Oh, yeah. There's something off with him. And again, I don't think that necessarily means that he was a child murderer. But yeah, these people are strange. And this case has a lot of really bizarre elements to it.
Well, we know what Chelsea will be thinking about this year. I know this happened 2 weeks ago, but I just want to talk to you because we haven't been able to talk about it. Celebrities talking about how much they love Brigitte Bardot only to learn how fucked up she was and have to retract their eulogies to her.
Truly the most insane thing I've ever witnessed in my life. Because, yeah, a lot of people posted about her, then immediately got dragged by people who were pointing out that she was notoriously bigoted and right-wing, like Chapel Roan.
I was going to say, the most egregious is Chapel Roan, where she wrote, "Rest in peace, Miss Bardot. She was my inspiration for Red Wine Supernova." Now, what I find so funny is if I were an unbelievably worldwide famous person who is known or believed to be on the correct side of politics, wouldn't you just Google a person's name plus the word problematic before you decided to publicly praise them?
No, and honestly, I don't think you should have to. I'm not saying that people shouldn't be pointing out that Brigitte Bardot is like a far right white nationalist, but also it's like she is a very famous actress who made significant contributions to culture. What this situation is telling me is that a lot of these people that were posting about her weren't actually fans to begin with. And I'm not a huge Brigitte Bardot fan, but if you know anything about this woman, it's like the fourth thing you learn about her after the movie she did, the song she sang, and the guy she fucked. It's like a foundational piece of knowledge about this woman. So I just find it funny that people are posting about her that maybe actually didn't know that much about her or care about her.
Yeah, I love that later Chapel Roan walked back her praise and condemned her views, but she didn't specify which thing she thought was objectionable about Brigitte Bardot. It's like, was it her racism? Was it the hate speech that was so bad that she was fined by a French court 6 times? Was it her right-wing leanings, the homophobia, the misogyny, the fact that she hated her child and talked about it in her memoir?
Okay, but let's be real. Like, for Chapel Roan's generation, and probably for most millennials, Brigitte Bardot represents a beauty ideal. Back in the day, it was more than that. She was representing a sort of sexually liberated kind of woman. But nowadays, it's really about the way that she did her hair, the way that she did her eyeliner, and that look, which is what I believe Chapel Roan was alluding to in Red Wine Supernova. People look at her more like a model.
I stand the look, not her point of view.
Okay, but also the thing, it's like, wait, you guys are surprised that an old French woman is problematic? Like, have you met one old French woman in your life? Which is not to say, like, actually, I don't want to generalize. Like, if you want a woke ass, like, French woman, get into Jean Seberg or Delphine Seyrig or something. RIP to those legends. But also, I don't like the fact that, like, the Instagram accounts for Criterion Collection and Turner Classic Movies are getting dragged for posting about her.
Oh, no, that's unfair.
Like, she has deplorable views, sure, but she made really significant contributions to cinema and to French culture, which is why they're posting about her.
You're reminding me that it's going to be a nightmare for those two social media pages when Roman Polanski and or Woody Allen dies.
Yeah, that was a real minefield for that week that I just saw nothing but these sorts of Instagram posts.
That poor social media person for Criterion and Turner Classic Movie fighting for their life over the holiday. They're like, I fucked up on my PTO, so I have to go back to work on the 27th and like delete these hateful Brigitte Bardot comments.
Okay, you know what? This is actually what I don't get, because I would understand how people wouldn't know that Brigitte Bardot was like this if not for the fact that literally, like, not even 5 minutes into the pilot episode of The White Lotus, which, as I understand, every person watched, I think it was Sydney Sweeney or maybe it was the other girl. She was describing the Jennifer Coolidge character, and she was like, oh, she's like an American Brigitte Bardot, loves animals, hates Jews. Like, that was the joke that we all just watched no less than 5 years ago.
In Chappelle Ronan's defense, I don't remember that line from The White Lotus.
Chappelle Ronan? Anyway, speaking of right-wing divas, can we briefly talk about Nicki Minaj's Kiki with Erica Kirk?
We can indeed. We can touch down in this, but only briefly. So, yeah. For the final day, I hate that I had to fucking research this, just FYI. So Nicki Minaj appeared as the special guest for the Turning Point USA's America Fest. Chelsea, 30,000 people attended this. It is a four-day event that hosted panels like why dismantling the Department of Education is critical, mass migration is causing all the problems, actually, and of course, daily prayer with evangelical pastor Greg Laurie.
Sounds like a dream.
So Nicki Minaj came out with Charlie Kirk's widow, Erica Kirk, and they had a whole conversation together.
I watched like the first 15 minutes of it, and then I got bored. I think it's hard to watch because the way Nicki Minaj speaks is so slow and stilted that it takes her like 5 minutes to say a single sentence.
How do you feel about this? Because you are a Nicki Minaj fan. I would say I'm agnostic about her. I do have a theory about why she's getting into the right-wing grift, but I'm curious your opinion about this.
Well, this isn't how I found out that she was a Republican. She rapped about voting for Mitt Romney ages ago. And as a fan, that's something I can live with, but aligning herself with Turning Point and being MAGA is just, like, extremely embarrassing. Like, that's, like, on another level. But also, it's like, if this is her new public persona, I feel like we might as well get a weird Charlie Kirk remix or something from her. It's not surprising.
Oh my God.
She's burned every bridge that she could possibly burn. I mean, maybe not every bridge. She's not like to the Kanye West level of bridge burning yet, but it seems like she's on that path.
Well, I saw a theory that she has pivoted to the MAGA base as a way to get her husband and brother a presidential pardon, because both her husband and brother are convicted rapists.
Of course. Yeah, it's really fucking dark. It's extremely dark. It sucks.
Yeah, I mean, from that standpoint, I guess it's like, it's trying to find a little bit of meaning in this of why she would debase herself in these ways. But I feel like she could just make an appeal to Trump himself to get a pardon if that's what she really wanted.
I feel like she genuinely holds these views. I don't know if that's always been the case with her. I think with a lot of people, they've gone increasingly far right in recent years. And I could see how Nikki would go that way. I mean, I think it's really sad. I think it's gross and, like I said, most of all embarrassing. But also just to see her align herself with Erica Kirk is really fascinating, because these two, like, I haven't spent a lot of time watching Erica Kirk speak publicly in recent months. I see little clips of her here and there, but I was just struck by how profoundly joyful this woman was. Like, it honestly seems like she's living her best life. And it reminded me, I know you haven't seen Oh Mary, Lauren, but it's so Oh Mary, because in that play, it's like the whole thing is that Mary Todd Lincoln is like cooped up in the White House and Lincoln is like stopping her from living her dreams. And then Lincoln gets assassinated and she can like live her best life. And that's kind of the vibe I'm getting from this. Like, I feel like she's stepped into her light in a really major way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a whole meme format on Twitter about this where it's like, you know, Erica Kirk after her husband dies and it's like shooting off fireworks. Like, this is the best thing that has happened to her. You know, I get it. We all grieve in different ways, but she seems quite happy.
Yeah, she really does. It's wild. It's also very like Handmaid's Tale-esque. There is a similar plot line on that show where Joseph Fiennes played a far-right political leader that got murdered by the resistance, and then his wife had to fill his shoes, which was kind of at odds with their belief that, like, women should be at home raising kids and, like, not be allowed to read and shit. Some parallels.
Yeah, I will be intrigued to see how long the Turning Point audience is fine with having Erica Kirk be the head of this organization.
It seems like they're really into it. Like, I think they're obsessed with her. I think she's like a star, like a superstar. But I can't help but wonder about Nicki Minaj's future, which I assume will end up being a Lil' Kim type situation where it's just about kind of like sad club appearances. And you know what I mean?
Well, before people think that we're going to be making a MAGA pivot, shall we start discussing other things? There's more bad news to discuss.
Sure, let's pivot. We've talked about Brigitte Bardot, but another really glamorous French woman died recently, which is Jacqueline de Ribes. She was a countess and a socialite and a fashion designer and truly one of the most glamorous women to walk the face of this earth. She was one of the Truman Capote swans, although he didn't write about her in the Esquire article. She was a bit out of that world, or at least he didn't have any dirt on her. So she didn't turn on him, but she was just like the most iconic socialite.
Yeah, they don't make them like that anymore. Like, this is a woman who met Diana Vreeland, and Diana Vreeland immediately called Richard Avedon and was like, you need to photograph this woman. And he did the very next day.
Yeah, I think shit just worked like that back in the 60s, but it really is the end of an era with her death, because she is the last one of those women that is standing, like the swans, I mean. There are none of them left. There never will be anything like that ever again.
Because we live in a compulsive time. I mean, we're doing it now by having a podcast, but like, they don't make chic women like this anymore. Like, she vowed to never write a memoir. And guess what? There is no one's memoir I'd rather read than hers.
I know. Well, also just the world that she inhabited doesn't exist. Like, no one is going to, like, costume balls like that anymore. It's a world that is just gone, that we can now only really experience through photographs and stuff. Anyway, as you can imagine, this woman was an insane couture collector, and there was an exhibition of her wardrobe at the Costume Institute in 2015. It was actually the last show that Harold Coda did before Andrew Bolton took over as the head curator. And our dear friend and mentor, Jessica Glasscock, invited me to be her date to the opening of that exhibition, which was truly one of the most fabulous New York nights of my life. Although, tragically, Jacqueline was not there, which was sad. I believe she had some health issues, and she would have been in her mid-80s at that time. She died at 96, I believe. But the show was incredible. It was very gown heavy, mostly stuff from the 60s, 70s, 80s, the best YSL, Dior, Ungaro, and a lot of her own designs as well. She was a fashion designer. She started a line in the 80s, which was mostly evening wear. Great gowns, beautiful gowns, as Aretha Franklin would say, that weren't dissimilar from a lot of those designers that I just mentioned. She clearly was inspired by them, and they were also inspired by her.
RIP to a legend.
Truly.
So, Chelsea, you may have heard that Saks Fifth Avenue is in some trouble.
Yes, but I've been completely ignoring the entire situation, so give me the Reader's Digest.
I would be happy to, because I spent an afternoon going down this rabbit hole and gave myself a headache trying to understand what is going on. It is truly labyrinthian. So over the holidays, Saks missed a $100 million debt payment. Debt that they took on to buy Neiman Marcus and Bergdorf Goodman about a year and a half ago for $2.65 billion. Now, Saks can't pay their vendors, but they thought it would be a great idea to borrow a bunch of money to buy Neiman Marcus. Allegedly, the goal was to form a luxury powerhouse. And they said that it would provide cost-saving measures and they'd have more leverage with brands. You're going to see this feels like the department store version of too big to fail. So they were able to make their first interest payment of $120 million in July, which investors were already nervous they wouldn't be able to do. And at the time, the Saks CEO, Mark Metrick, told the New York Times, "We are setting this balance sheet the right way. I think people need to see that, and I'm looking forward to showing them." Well, he won't be able to show them any longer because after they missed this debt payment, he stepped down as CEO. He had been with the company since 1995, having all different roles, eventually becoming the CEO of Saks, and then being sacrificed after they missed these totally unnecessary payments. Like, they didn't need to take this debt on. They could have just tried to make Saks work. Anyway, he is being replaced by Saks Global Executive Chairman Richard Baker, who seems to be the architect of this ungodly Neiman's merger and also the angel of death for major department stores, because previous to this, he purchased Lord & Taylor, the department store chain, in 2006, sold it in 2019 as a shell of its former self, only for the new owner to shut down all of its brick and mortar stores the following year. He basically did the same thing to Hudson's Bay, which was a department store chain in Canada, which he bought in 2008. And he liquidated the entire company last year, ending its 355-year existence. And now this week, they are contemplating filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. But then I also saw that they're trying to secure and negotiate a $1 billion loan, Chelsea. I do not understand what's going on. Like, going back 18 months, the amount of like debt restructuring they've done gave me a headache. Again, I say, like, this feels like the department store version of too big to fail.
It's just so fucking depressing. Like, we can't just have one department store. So they all could go under, basically. Or Saks, and then by extension, Neiman Marcus. And what else do they own?
Well, Neiman Marcus is tied to Bergdorf Goodman.
So,
we could no longer have Bergdorf Goodman.
So fucked up. Well, especially after watching Mannequin recently, it's like, it reminded me of like how great a department store can be.
I know. I don't quite understand why they couldn't just fix Saks, how they needed to buy two other gigantic department stores. Also, to alleviate the pressures of the money they owe, they sold the Neiman Marcus building in Beverly Hills and the Neiman Marcus in San Francisco. That's how it was reported. And I was like, oh my God, so no more Neiman Marcus in Beverly Hills. There goes the best bar on the top floor. But no, it's more confusing, Chell. They sold the land beneath the buildings. So both of the locations will still be fully operational. They've just entered long-term lease deals instead of owning the buildings.
That seems like an act of desperation.
Well, Chelsea, this should not be confused for the rehabilitation of the old Saks buildings on Wilshire. For those who don't live in Los Angeles, on Wilshire Boulevard, there was Barney's of New York, two Saks buildings, and Neiman Marcus. Saks vacated their two older locations and moved over to the what was Barney's of New York is now Saks. So I had no idea this was happening. Those two old Saks buildings are being turned into, among many other things, a 6-story tall building where 4 levels will be office space and 2 levels will be retail and restaurants. The Saks men's building will be transformed into a 42-room boutique hotel with a private social club and a spa open to the public. And then also, like, somewhere amongst all of this is another residential building that's going to have another ground level of retail and 6 levels of apartments. And Chelsea, if you can believe it, somehow there's even more room. They're going to put another apartment complex and a parking structure that can accommodate 774 parking spots.
Hates it.
Again, I say, maybe more time paying vendors on time so they want to work with you again, and less time developing a multi-building, multi-use complex. Like, what are we doing here?
And as if things couldn't get more depressing, the old Fred Siegel building, which is on Melrose, has a very famous ivy facade, and the ivy just fell off. Do we know how this happened? Like, the store hasn't been Fred Siegel in a really, really long time, but it still at least looked like a Fred Siegel.
I believe because of the rain, the ivy, just the weight of all the water on the ivy fell off. This is another thing. I mean, I was waiting for you to get back to discuss this because it's a little inside LA, but we were under the impression there was a whole thing between Fred Siegel and Ron Herman. And Ron Herman technically owned that building, but they still called it Fred Siegel. And the thought was that they were revamping that building. It has been closed for more than a year. And now I'm worried it's never going to reopen. And this is my public plea to Dover Street Market to open up a second LA location in that spot.
Or just move so we never have to go to the Arts District again. There's room for the Rose Cafe in the former Morrow space. Or is that still open? No, it couldn't be.
That restaurant is not open, but I see it on Postmates all the time. And I'm like, is it just a ghost kitchen now? I don't know.
Deeply depressing.
I think the lesson here beyond retail is dying is I just think in general, loading up businesses with a bunch of bad debt that you realistically could never pay back is not a great business decision. But like, what do I know? Chell, I don't know if you saw this, but like, this comes up a lot with private equity buying successful companies. Like, this happened over the holidays and it went kind of viral, where the founder of Sprinkles was shocked to discover that her company, which she sold to private equity in 2014, abruptly and unceremoniously shut down all of their locations, like overnight, no warning.
I feel very bad for the employees, but how long did Sprinkles need to be a business?
I mean, I never understood the cupcake and an ATM.
Yeah, it's a deranged concept that made sense at the time. And now it's like, what?
It was a concept that made sense when Obama was president.
People were like, damn, I can't get enough of these red velvet mini cupcakes. I used to work quite close to a Sprinkle. So it's like I've consumed enough Sprinkles, because when you work in an office, inevitably people start bringing in boxes of that shit. But I'm sorry, Magnolia did it better. Maybe that's why they're still around.
Well, we've come to the end of bad news. And if the fuckettes will just indulge us a little longer, we have to talk about Kevin Spacey's tar moment in Tel Aviv. I don't know if you saw this clip, Chelsea.
Oh, yeah. I've watched many clips from his cabaret act. And I would argue that this particular scenario is actually much darker than Tar. When you think about it, it makes me think that Lydia Tar didn't actually hit rock bottom. There is another level that she could have fallen to.
So for those who have not seen this video, because it appeared on my timeline with almost no context, it is the disgraced actor Kevin Spacey dancing behind a jazz orchestra, at points tap dancing. There are other clips of him singing Frank Sinatra. And it is clear that he can no longer get work in America. So he is going from club to club singing jazz standards.
Well, apparently he was on a 3-city tour which also included Cyprus and Greece. But then Greece was like, actually, you can't do a show here if you're performing in Israel. So he was like, I'm just going to cancel the show in Greece. So then it became a two-city tour.
So I was going to say, there is a Telegraph article with him from the fall that is reporting from his show in Cyprus. And so I went down this rabbit hole and found out he has a whole show, because the way that the video looks is like, oh, he's just performing at random clubs. And it's like, no, he has a whole performance that he's done and created called Kevin Spacey Songs and Stories. Chelsea, it is a rare chance to experience a true Hollywood star in his element on stage, backed by a live jazz band, delivering the timeless standards that defined a generation. With the elegance of Sinatra, the wit of Dean Martin, and a career that spans decades of unforgettable performances, Spacey brings a voice and presence that's simply unmatched. Oh, they also note that this is not just a concert. It's not just an evening of stories. It's the return of an entertainer in the grandest sense of the word.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I don't know if this is more embarrassing than Lydia Tarr's fate, because, again, these clips make it seem like he's performing in a small club. He's not. He's performing to, like, thousands of people, and ticket prices range from 250 euros to a special VIP package that included a 30-minute meet and greet for 1,200 euros.
I think it's darker because Lydia Tarr is a better musician.
That's right. Kevin Spacey is sort of forced into this category. He did do that film Beyond the Sea where he was Bobby Darin. So, like, this is a persona I think he always had inside of him. Like, you know, there's vibrato up by where you live, and it's a jazz club. And, like, Seth MacFarlane, the creator of Family Guy, his special interest is Sinatra. And so he will just go to vibrato and perform Sinatra there.
Yeah, Kevin Spacey could be better. Could be worse, certainly. Although I was mostly just disappointed that he didn't say anything dishy during his, like, you know, banter in between the songs. Like, he didn't talk about his cancellation at all, really, in any real way.
How many clips did you end up watching of Kevin Spacey's performance?
I watched a few. I mean, mostly just the same one of him doing, like, a really tragic, like, soft shoe sort of tap dance kind of routine. That's the one that really made the rounds. But I'm sad that I wasn't able to see his entrance, because apparently the show opens with a montage of his, like, greatest performances and also, like, him, like, winning an Oscar and stuff.
He's won 2 Oscars, if you can believe it.
Both of his Oscars.
Wow. He made his own clip package. Like, at least with The Golden Eve, a host of editors made Helen Mirren and Sarah Jessica Parker's clip package.
We didn't talk about the Kevin Spacey docuseries because it was, like, so incredibly dark. But there was a detail that continues to haunt me, which is that he jerked off in a movie theater during the D-Day scene in Saving Private Ryan. And I feel like not enough people are talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the jokes for this incredibly dark situation kind of write themselves, which is he was not pretending to be, or he was not acting as Kaiser Soze. Like, he is Kaiser Soze.
Yeah, he's deeply evil and probably mentally unwell to some degree.
Oh, another thing that people don't talk about enough is, you know, that his brother is a Rod Stewart impersonator.
I did know that. Yes. That was also addressed in the docuseries.
I find canceled men in the post-Me Too era so confusing, because Johnny Depp is like this too. Like, they swing wildly from, like, being destitute and crying poor to booked and busy. Because I feel like the last headline with Kevin Spacey was like, I'm so poor, I have to sell my house because of all of the lawyer's fees. Like, I've been completely wiped out. And in this Telegraph interview from last fall when he was performing in Cyprus, he's like, I have no home.
I believe that. If you're used to the money coming in, something catastrophic happens, you can no longer work. I mean, Johnny Depp could live off of that Sauvage campaign alone, even if he wasn't acting, which he still is.
I'm just shaking my head. Well, I feel like there's only one way to end the show, which is to torment the fuckettes with Kevin Spacey singing Frank Sinatra.
Perfect way to end our bad news segment. It's been good catching up, Lauren. I'll see you in person next week.
I hope. I mean, I desperately miss you and can't wait to see you. But if I were you, I'd stay in Australia, man.
I don't know. Things haven't been great here lately either. So anyway, on that note, see you next week.
See you next week, guys. Bye.